Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The 1960s established rock and roll as a movement of peace and love and community. By the 1970s, it became sex and drugs and rock and roll. According to writer Michael Walker, 1973 was the watershed year, and three tours in particular marked a turning point. The book is called What You Want Is in the Limo, On the Road with Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who in 1973, the year the 60s died and the modern rock star was born. Michael Walker, that's a heck of a title.
Yeah, but, I know. Thank you, I guess.
First of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thank you for having me.
What You Want Is in the Limo is a line from David Bowie's Fame, which is not from 1973. You got a little creative anachronism there because that comes later. But
yeah,
it talks to the kind of hedonism and entitlement that grows up in 1973. What was going on that year?
A couple of things are going on. I think 1973 is a very interesting year because it's a year with one foot in the 60s and one foot in the 70s. There's some of the peace and love ethic from the 1960s was still alive in the early 1970s. I mean, the lyrics that Robert Plant was writing on the album Houses of the Holy, which was released in 1973, in the song Dancing Days, he literally says, "I got my flower, I got my power, I got a woman who knows." I mean, that's not exactly 1970s imagery, which we imagine in the 1970s. At the same time, the record industry is blowing up a little bit. There's a new generation of listeners and record buyers coming into play, and they are the baby brothers and sisters of the classic baby boomers who were born in the late 40s. The baby boomers born in 1957, the peak year of baby boomer births, and there were 18 million of them in North America, come of age in 1973. And with that, they bring their buying power to the marketplace and their tastes. And so they've been raised sort of listening to the 60s music that their older brothers and sisters had played, the Cream records and Beatles and Stones and all that. But they wanted their own music. And the music that they wanted was stuff like Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, Deep Purple, I mean, Uriah Heep. I mean, the bands just go on and on. These are bands that the original baby boomers, who were 10 years older than them, found appalling. I mean, Led Zeppelin, people don't realize this, but how uncool Led Zeppelin was in the rock firmament in the early 1970s.
Well, you write quite a bit about how the critics, most critics, just would not give them the time of day. Meanwhile, they're selling millions of copies and filling arenas. Now, as I mentioned, the title of the book, What You Want Is in the Limo, comes from David Bowie, who was on his Ziggy Stardust tour in 1973, but you chose to go with Alice Cooper instead. Why?
I chose Alice Cooper because that band has never quite been given its due. And it was a band. It was a five-member band called Alice Cooper and with a lead singer named Alice Cooper, which was causing tremendous amounts of problems within the band that year as the band felt they'd been turned into a backup band. But they were an extremely revolutionary band, and I really wanted to give them credit for what they did, which was bringing theatricality to live performance and writing these albums that were sort of like, they were almost like Gilbert and Sullivan plays. I mean, they had a theme. They were writing about things that no one else was writing about at the time. There were some, I mean, Alice Cooper told me when I interviewed him for the book, he said, "Look, we were not the Buffalo Springfield, okay? We were writing about switchblades and guns and limousines and in many ways they were more in tune with what was happening in the early 1970s because to double back what I was saying about that new generation coming in, there's tremendous amounts of money start to hit the record business in the early 1970s. There were albums moving millions of copies, and the concerts were also going up from ballrooms like the old Fillmore's in San Francisco and New York to these big hockey arenas, 14, 15,000-seat hockey arenas. And so the money was just going through the roof all of a sudden. That's contributing to this decadence. That's contributing to the contract writers that are specifying, you know, vintage cognacs, that the limousines have to be Lincolns or Cadillacs. They're giving you writing on the side of them. And people are starting to rent private planes like Led Zeppelin and Alice Cooper did.
And Alice Cooper demanding that his Budweiser be brewed in America, even if the concert was in Canada. He was touring behind the album Billion Dollar Babies with a stage that cost $250,000, which was not chump change back then in 1973. This is one of the songs he was touring around.
I'm your choice. I wanna be a
Alice Cooper with Elected from the album Billion Dollar Babies. The band Alice Cooper touring the States pretty relentlessly, Michael, in 1973 with their huge theatrical stage. And he's eviscerating baby dolls on stage and getting his head chopped off in the guillotine and stuff like that. I mean, it was a real kind of danse macabre happening out on stage every night.
Oh, yeah, and that was totally calculated. Alice Cooper, when they started out in Los Angeles, and they were probably the most unpopular band in L.A. They were famous for clearing ballrooms. they used to open their shows with the theme to the Patty Duke show. So they were kind of postmodernists and ironists well before that became popular, like with David Letterman-style humor. They were way, way ahead of their time in that regard. They were parodying the whole Peace and Love generation. They were just skewering it, and that was their mission. Shep Gordon, their manager, was an incredibly talented guy when it came to marketing this band, decided to just do some sort of cultural jujitsu and take their negative image and make that the focus of the band and get lots and lots and lots of bad publicity about them, thereby driving a lot of press and a lot of outrage in the straight press, thereby selling more records and getting more people to come to the concerts. And by 1973, they've been at this 5 years, it really finally reached its critical mass, shall we say.
Yeah.
The stage show is the most outrageous they'd done. I mean, Alice is getting his head chopped off every night. There are rumors about the band that are just outrageous, that they're fueling as much as they possibly can because it'll create even more bad publicity. So Alice was like the scourge of middle-class America. Shep Gordon told me, he said, my goal was that I wanted a kid, if he mentioned at the breakfast table he was going to buy an Alice Cooper record, he'd be grounded for a month. So
that's what he wanted. So, that's what he was going for.
So, but that at the same time, they were also they weren't certainly the greatest musicians in the world, but they were very hardworking and they'd really gotten their Michael Bruce, the guitar player who wrote the song, part of that song Elected that we were just hearing. They'd really, really honed their chops and were really in fighting trim by the time they hit that tour.
We're speaking with Michael Walker, who wrote the national bestseller Laurel Canyon, the inside story of rock and roll's legendary neighborhood some years ago. His new book is What You Want is in the Limo. Talks about the tours from 1973 of Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who. 1973 being the year the 60s died and the modern rock star was born. The Who occupy an unusual space in that timeline, Michael. And you write about how they had kind of unique problems being that they were part of that legacy of the 1960s.
Yeah, in 1973, The Who released Quadrophenia, which was their second full-length rock opera after Tommy. And Pete Townshend at that time was absolutely just transfixed with anxiety that the band had to change and become relevant if it was going to soldier on through the 70s. And he was right about that. And so what Quadrophenia, the album, and this tour were envisioned as a way to deal with the band's past. So they were formed in 1963, so they were sort of elder statesmen at this point. They were getting a little long in the tooth. He was very worried about that. Unfortunately, by Quadrophenia is essentially an opera about the early days. It's essentially the story of The Who in the early 60s in London and the mod scene in London. Unfortunately, in the United States in 1973, 10 years was like 100 years had gone by. So much culturally had happened by then. Most Americans were not familiar with the mod scene. And so when they went out on the road with this thing and the album came out, there's a lot of mystification. People just weren't buying into it. Of course, now it's considered a classic Who album, one of the greatest albums of the 20th century. And all that. But at the time, it was a little bit of a miscue, and people didn't really get into it that much. And it was very frustrating for the band to go out every night and have to listen to people hooting and hollering for Won't Get Fooled Again when they're trying to do, songs like Punk and the Godfather.
Or Love, Rain, or Me. And then having to, and sort of shooting themselves in the foot, as you write, because they're trying to explain each song from the stage to an audience that, as you say, just wants to hear the hits. And now, we listen to a song like this and we think, God, what were they on back then?
Only love can make it rain the way the beach is kissed by the sea. Only love can make it rain, like the sweat of lovers laying in the fields. Love, rain on me.
Rain or Me, now considered a classic from The Who's album Quadrophenia from their troubled tour of 1973. Michael Walker, let me repeat something I said just a moment ago. What were they on back then?
Do you mean the band or the audience?
Either, both.
The band's thinking was they were trying to present this. It was so difficult to stage this thing because of all the, as we just heard in Love Rain Over Me, those are synthesized strings. There was lots of background sounds or whistling locomotives and tea kettles and crashing waves. And they were putting this on live, but they were using analog tapes. And a guy on the side of the stage had to push these buttons to make these tapes fire at the right time. And it never worked. John Entwistle just said one time, he said, we had to perform it absolutely flawlessly or it fell apart. And it often did. And their opening in San Francisco, Keith Moon, who was not known to resist any sort of temptation. So apparently two groupies backstage gave him a drink that was spiked with some sort of extremely powerful drug, probably an animal tranquilizer. He made it through most of the concert. In fact, made it through all of Quadrophenia. And all of a sudden, he passed out face first into his drums. And so they pulled him off stage, gave him a shower and a shot of B12, put him back on stage. He played a little bit longer. And then he fell backwards up for the drums. And there's video footage of this. There's a website called Wolfgang's Vault, and you can see the footage of this. And they more or less kind of like haul him off like a big fish off stage. And and then Pete Townsend said, they're going along really great. And he said he was frustrated. He wanted to keep playing. So he said to the audience, does anybody play the drums?
Is there a drummer in the house?
Well, it turns out there was. And the guy in the front row was a kid from Iowa visiting a friend of his. And his friend said, yeah, he could play the drums. The guy's going, no. But the next thing you know, Bill Graham, the promoter, the famous Bill Graham, is seizing this guy. He goes, can you really do it? And the guy goes, yeah, I guess so. So they take him back, say, they give him a shot of brandy. And the next thing you know, he's sitting down behind Keith Moon's drums. I mean, can you imagine? This guy's from Muscatine, Iowa. He's been a bar band drummer his whole life. And he's sitting behind Keith Moon. And Pete Townsend reaches to the cymbals, which is a great image. He shakes his hands and goes, okay, I'm just going to lead you. Just follow me. And they played three songs, and then they hung it up. And the guy did good. His name was Scott Halpin. And he said after the concert that He said he had great respect for The Who and for Keith Moon in particular because he said he only played three songs with him. He said he was exhausted.
Yeah.
He could barely stand up after this.
Now, a lot of these guys could barely stand up when they got onto the stage. I mean, you know, this is part of the whole the rock star, you know, lifestyle as we head on into 1973. The drugs get more expensive, but they also get more easy to obtain and hard to resist. And so a lot of that is happening too. How much is the public aware of all of the backstage shenanigans, the groupies in the limo and the drugs in the hotel rooms and stuff like that?
No, the answer is they weren't very aware of it. I remember being at the International Amphitheater in Chicago in 1973 at a Humble Pie concert, which they were a great band from the 70s.
And Peter Frampton's old band.
Yeah, it was Peter Frampton. He was the original lead guitar player in Humble Pie. You're right. I remember being herded into the International Amphitheater in Chicago. Was next to the old stockyards in Chicago. So it always smelled faintly of cow manure. So here's this audience packed into this arena, 14,000 people. There's no seats on the main floor. It's festival seating. And I remember kind of looking around the backstage barrier, and the band's on stage in their blue jeans and, you know, very much down with the people. And I could see these three Cadillac limousines back there. I said, okay, this has fascinated me ever since. I said, the front of the house is not agreeing with the back of the house. And what was going on in the back of the house was these guys were traveling around like young princes. They were demanding, we mentioned before, Alice Cooper, the Budweiser had to be in bottles. It had to be brewed in the United States. And if they were in Canada, you had to import it from the U.S. Led Zeppelin, on their tour, there was a guy, they were staying at the Ambassador East in Chicago, which is a great rock and roll hotel, and each guy had a suite. And there was a guy named Danny Marcus who was working for Atlantic Records, Zeppelin's label, and he was deputized to put stereos in each one of the band members' suites. And so he goes to a lot of trouble, gets really fancy stereos. He stopped in to visit Robert Plant and Jimmy Page one day, he said, and we walked up to their suite, and he said, you couldn't see the stereo. And he went to Robert, well, where's the stereo? Did it work out okay? And Robert just beckoned him down the hallway to the bathroom, and he said he went to the bathroom. The stereo was in the bathtub in a foot of water. And so he said, Danny said, well, that was Robert's way of just saying the stereo didn't work out. So that was sort of the attitude. Yeah. You know, no excuses, no explanation. He said, look, I never let those guys see me sweat. He said, hey, you know, no problems. That was kind of the attitude of those two. Do you want cocaine? No problem. You want five groupies? No problem. Everything was provided.
But one of the points you make is in 1973, this becomes part of the image. You want the public to see this because you want them to think you're a star, that you are different, that you are on a different plane somehow.
Yeah, speaking of planes, I mean...
Yeah, speaking of planes.
in 1973, we were coming into a pretty serious energy crisis. The country's in stagflation. The economy's in terrible shape. And Led Zeppelin's flying around a plane called the Starship, which was... Alice Cooper rented it later that year. And it says, David Lieber, Alice Cooper's road manager, said, he goes, it was the Air Force One for rock and roll. So you get in this plane, which could hold... It was a modified Boeing 707. It could hold 180 people normally. It was tricked out to hold maybe 20. And you walk in, there's like shag carpeting, and there's a big long bar, and an electric organ, and a stateroom with a round waterbed in it. My favorite touch was there's this drawing room, tricked out like a Tudor drawing room in an English mansion with a fake fireplace, so all the British bands could go back and kind of like feel like they're home in their mansions. But nobody was trying to hide this stuff. They were flaunting it. There's this classic photo, it's in the book by Bob Gruen, taken at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, of Zeppelin posing in front of their plane with the Led Zeppelin logo on the side. And it's just, it is such a great photograph because the looks on their faces is this strange mixture of pride and just complete naked smugness. I mean, these guys are rock stars and, you know, and there's some wish fulfillment in that. I mean, the audience, guys in the 70s, 60s, maybe, I don't know what their heroes were. Maybe they wanted to be football players, but in the 70s, you wanted to be a rock star because you got the girls, you got the plane, you got the drugs, you know, what was there to like?
And Led Zeppelin, as they were touring in 1973... They were also filming. So, you know, that movie, The Song Remains the Same, you know, they may not be great performances. It is certainly not a great movie, but it is a document of Led Zeppelin at the top of their fame, if not the top of their game. And here's that famous recording of Stairway to Heaven. Led Zeppelin live at Madison Square Garden here in New York, July of 1973, the year the 60s died and the modern rock star was born, according to my guest Michael Walker. We're talking about his book, What You Want Is in the Limo, on the road with three bands, Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who in 1973, that Stairway to Heaven. And you notice, Michael, none of the high notes being... even attempted by Robert Plant there. I mean, touring, even before you get to the drugs and the booze and the exhaustion, you know, touring is a difficult thing to do those songs night after night. Were these tours the high water marks? Would they turn out to be the high point of all three of those bands' careers?
Yeah, they really were. Creatively and artistically, this was, I think, 1973 was the years that these bands really kind of made their last and best efforts. I mean, Led Zeppelin, they took 18 months off the road after that tour. That was the longest time they've been off the road since they started. Alice Cooper had the number one album in the country. A tour that outgrossed Led Zeppelin's tour even, and they were the peak of their careers, and they broke up within a year of that tour happening. And The Who never revisited the creative foment that they had on Quadrophenia after that and spent the 70s making kind of desultory albums. None of these bands were ever the same after these tours.
Mm. It's a fun read, actually. It's one of those things, you might not want to be there, or maybe you would like to be there for a little while, but to spend a whole year in 1973 in one of these three tours would be a pretty exhausting thing. The book is called What You Want Is in the Limo, On the Road with Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, and The Who in 1973, the year the 60s died and the modern rock star was born. It's the latest book from Michael Walker. Fun stuff, Michael. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it.